You remember the prophet Ezekiel. He's most famous for that vision he had of the Valley of Dry Bones that we read at the Great Vigil. The first chapter of that book of the prophet Ezekiel, he has this, presents this wild vision, and it's called the throne chariot vision. You can go read it. I can just sort of highlight it. I mean, there are these wild angelic beings, and then there's this heavenly chariot with these wheels that turn in all sorts of ways. It's got all sorts of flashing lights on it, and at the top of the chariot, there's this dome, and above that, there's this throne. It looks like sapphire, and it reminds him of what a rainbow looks like in the clouds, and he says, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. Scholars tell us that some Jews had a prayer practice where they would imaginatively enter into this vision in order to deepen their awareness and experience of the presence and glory of God. So some suggest, N.T. Wright for one, that Saul may be doing this prayer practice, this throne chariot prayer practice, as he draws near to Damascus to arrest followers of Jesus of Nazareth, the crucified rebel and heretic. As his meditation deepens, if you go along with this, Saul sees the dome, and then he sees the lights, and then he sees the throne, and above the throne he sees a face, and you know, is this the face of God? And he strains to see more clearly, and then his vision is clarified, and he sees a face. But it's the last face on earth he ever wanted to see. It's the face of Jesus of Nazareth. And then he hears a voice, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And Saul says, who are you, Lord? And the voice matches the vision, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. And this shatters, utterly shatters Saul's world. And he would become Paul after this. His life has been guided by the worldview in which Gentiles and Jews were separate, in which faithful Jews were separated from sinners, and teachers like Jesus who hung out with Gentiles and sinners and broke bread with them were to be cursed and maybe in some ways and some occasions arrested and maybe even killed. But now this mental construct, this worldview, collapses, utterly collapses, and he loses his sight. 3 days later, as we heard, Jesus sends Ananias, just this poor, humble disciple in Damascus, to help begin reconstructing in Saul a Jesus-shaped worldview. He lays his hands on his former enemy and then says these remarkable words. He calls him, he says, Brother Saul. Brother Saul. I believe it was Nadia Boltz-Weber, a sort of a renegade Lutheran pastor who's a wonderful writer and speaker. She said it was about herself or someone else that she remembers. They were converted to Christ when they read that Ananias called his former enemy brother, brother. What kind of God can create a heart capable of turning around like that? And Saul, let's be clear, isn't converting to another religion. He remains a faithful Jew, but he now believes the crucified and risen Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the face of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. As he would write years later in 2 Corinthians, Christ is the image of God. That's what he saw in his vision. Then he says, Jesus Christ is the one who shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of God's glory in the face of Jesus Christ. Now, Saul's understanding, his worldview about the character and purposes of God is grounded in the character and purposes of Jesus. Saul's healing begins in an instant. But it would take years, and of course it always takes a lifetime, take years for the Spirit to rebuild in him this Jesus-shaped worldview. In Galatians, he says that after that traumatic encounter, he went into Arabia. He went to the desert. Maybe they think, maybe he went to Mount Sinai where God spoke to Moses. And then when he comes back, then he goes to his hometown of Tarsus and stays there 10 years. 10 years to let the Spirit rebuild his inner life. And then after 10 years, Barnabas, the name means son of encouragement, comes for Paul, takes him, brings him to Antioch, into the parish there, where he can experience the most unusual thing in the world. He experiences a community of people that are multi-ethnic, coming out of multi-religions, multi-economic classes. You have slaves and you have rich people, an all-inclusive community surrendered to the leadership of Jesus Christ. There was nothing else like this in the whole Roman world. And it's this experience of community that enabled Paul to write to the church in Galatia, "In Christ, there's neither Jew nor Greek or Gentile, neither slave nor free. There's not even male and female, for you are all one in Christ." His worldview has been totally reconstructed. Well, does this apply to us? Do we, by any chance, have any destructive worldviews and mental constructs that need to be replaced with a Jesus-shaped worldview? Well, of course we do. We're human beings. Of course we do. I recently finished an excellent book. I usually don't read much nonfiction when it comes to my fun reading. And it was Eric Larson's book called In the Garden of Beasts: Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. And it follows the American ambassador, William Dodd, and his family. They moved to Berlin in 1933, right, when Hitler and the Nazi Party have come to power. And during the first year, there are attacks on Jews, there are attacks on foreigners, but he doesn't think that's really anything too serious. It's a fringe element. It's not coming out of Hitler and the Nazi Party, he doesn't think. But then, you know, then 34 and in the year 35, he knows for a fact that the white supremacy and anti-Semitism of the Third Reich is a great sickness and a profound evil that, if not stopped, will grow into a force that can destroy the world. So he writes urgent cables to Washington to alert them to what's going on. Yet it's clear that his bosses at the State Department and in the White House don't really take him that seriously. And at one point, the author, Eric Larson, who's writing this, wonders aloud why this might be so. Why didn't the government respond and go public with what they knew was happening? Do the American leaders think it's possible maybe they can appease Hitler and he'll change? Maybe. Is it because there was also a strong anti-Jewish sentiment in America, which there was? Or could it be, he poses, that the U.S. doesn't want to point out the crimes of Hitler toward the Jews because that will open the door for Hitler to point out the crimes of America towards blacks? It's segregation. It's injustice. 119 lynchings in America during the 1930s. Maybe we just didn't want that pointed out to the world. This myth of white supremacy can be traced back to Tacitus and Aristotle and followed through to the Puritans and the Pilgrims, who came to this country to build a shining city on a hill filled with people that looked just like them. 200 years later, Frederick Douglass, the escaped slave who would become a world figure, when he came to Massachusetts, he came to New Bedford, lived two blocks down from Grace Church, New Bedford, where I was rector for a number of years. Frederick Douglass wrote this. He said, "I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore," he said, "hate the corrupt, slave-holding, women-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity of this land." 170 years after that destructive worldview brought about that civil war. Now, we, in this world, we still breathe that air. After a while, maybe we wonder, maybe we shouldn't fight it because some of us get better access to work and education and money than others. So how does God deconstruct slaveholder Christianity when all who believe it are already, they claim, faithful followers of Christ? How do you do that? Well, here's what my imagination said. So imagine with me a man named Fred. Fred doesn't exist. I made him up. Fred. Any Freds here, I apologize if I'm using your name. Fred is a white supremacist on his way to Charlottesville, Virginia, to participate in the rally on August 11th and 12th, 2017. Many of you will remember images of that. And on his way, he is practicing Ezekiel's throne chariot vision. And as his meditation deepens, he begins to see God's glory glowing from the throne, and he senses he's being drawn into the divine love, because the divine love does include him, just as the divine love includes us. And so he lifts his eyes of his heart even higher up. He dares to look higher and then sees something sitting on the throne, and he sees a face. But it simply can't be. He sees the face of God seated on the throne. But that face does not have the same color as his face. And he hears a voice. "Fred, Fred, why do you persecute me?" And Fred says, "Who are you, Lord?" And the voice matches the vision. "I'm Jesus, who you are persecuting." "But Lord, when did I persecute you?" And Jesus says, "Whenever you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, Fred, you did it to me." "But I love you, Lord." Then Jesus says, "Do you love me?" "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus says to him, "Feed my lambs." A second time he says to him, "Fred, do you love me?" He says, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus says to him, "Tend my sheep." He says to him the third time, "Fred, do you love me?" And Fred says to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus says to him, "Feed my sheep, all my sheep, even my black and brown and red sheep." And Fred, "My beloved child, follow me."